Okay.
Is that working?
Yeah.
So I switched from the conference to the workshop, but I didn't read the fine print regarding the level of the talks. So this will be a talk which hopefully emphasizes the physical ideas and delays some of the technical equations, but you'll see a few, and you can ask me regarding them during questions or later. So there are sort of two pieces of work. One, the ongoing piece of work I'm doing right now with Matt Schwartz, and there's a paper that I'll refer to a few times with my collaborator, David Kaplan. Okay, so in this talk, I'm going to be juggling all of these topics and attempting not to get burned. And we'll be talking about things that you've heard about already, Lorentz violation, negative energies, superluminality, a variety of weird things. And I personally am somebody who trembles to meddle with gravity, because every time you do it in any significant way, you do get burned. And so I really need a good reason why I would play with these ideas. And I think there is a good reason that we have a deep mystery and we have experiments in principle that can help us resolve it if only we know how to think about them. And so this is my excuse for playing with all these other noxious substances. And the only tools I have to sort of stop from making fundamental errors is that everything I talk about, and most of the talk will be introducing these ideas and why they're relevant to thinking about dark energy, but the tools that I will sort of delay as much as possible showing you, for me, the tools are, first of all, being very modestly ambitious only. That is, I'll be trying technically, while I have these ideas that I think are broadly stateable, technically, I'll be trying to test them out by thinking about processes that involve only a few particles at a time. Okay, so we know, gravitational fields in the real world have, oodles of quanta, oodles of gravitons, but at least your ideas, your clever ideas, should at least work when you're scattering a few gravitons at a time or doing a loop of matter, finding radiative corrections. And so I'm ultimately going to be convinced myself by playing with Feynman diagrams, where I know what the rules of the game are, I know what the cutting relations that keep track of probability conservation are, and I know what stability is. At the least, I understand these concepts at the level of a few particles at a time in weakly coupled Feynman diagrams. Okay, so that's what I do to stay honest. Okay, so let me go around the clock in this direction, because one thing leads to another to some extent. I knew this would happen. See, the trouble is, this is a loner laptop, and I've forgotten the password that I put into it. So if this thing shuts down my machine, that's the end of the talk. And that'll happen whenever somebody asks a tricky question. Okay, so one way, Lorentz violation is such a harsh way of saying that you're violating something beautiful. The better way to say it, the beautiful way to say it, is emergent relativity, okay? That relativity comes out, blossoms like a flower, okay? And I want to talk about that idea without gravity first, because we really understand this well between, statistical physics, or if you like, I should say, solid state physics and particle physics, we do understand this. So here is the simplest of simple things, which is there are very simple spin chains, that is, quantum mechanical theories where space is a lattice and the degrees of freedom look very, very discrete, okay? And there's some lattice spacing between these discrete degrees of freedom. And is this Lorentz invariant? Of course not. If you run along this way, then the space between the lattice sites would be Lorentz contracted, and you would certainly know. Okay, so this is far from a relativistic theory. It's just the innocent quantum spin chain. And there is this change of degrees of freedom, basically working in terms of kinks as the fundamental variables rather than the obvious thing you see, spins, where you can turn this into a theory of lattice fermion fields, okay? So, and that will be the simplest illustration of the point I'm making. So here is the theory of lattice fermions and the dispersion relation that you get, okay? So this is just some field, some glorious transformation of this problem can be turned into a problem of fermions, exclusion principle, that's what I mean. And the dispersion relation for these particles looks like this, okay? And you'll see why I wrote the double lines in a second, if this is just a single line. The main thing is that the maximum momenta on a lattice is pi over A, the lattice spacing. And so momentum is naturally cut off in this way because space is discretized. Okay, so you all know this. And of course, there's nothing very relativistic looking about this dispersion relation. And the vacuum is you put one fermion here, which hardly looks like a relativistic dispersion relation if you start moving around. Okay? So, but you, because these are fermion, then this could be done with bosons too. It's just not as Lego blockish as doing it this way. You could use the conserved fermion number to populate all the negative energy states that you see here. I've just drawn energy at some point to be zero energy. So all of these low-lying states, you could just populate using the exclusion principle. And this is creating for us a Dirac C, if you like. And we're going to call this the Minkowski vacuum. Okay? Why? Because simple excitations of this vacuum state, of course, it's the vacuum with a fixed number of particles there. And now we could always add a particle to it. And if this particle will see the dispersion relation here, which is linear, and where you could sort of think of that as sort of the slope of this as the speed of light of some emergent theory of relativity, here's the speed of light. Another way of saying it, as long as this momentum is small, then the associated wavelengths are large compared to the lattice. And so particle excitations in this vicinity, they don't see the lattice. And so it's at least possible that they think that there's boost invariance, okay? And indeed, this relativistic dispersion relation looks like the first step, okay? I won't do all the steps in making interesting models. Of course, you can also get antiparticles, if you know this too. You know that you can put holes in there. That's an absence of a negative energy state, which is also a positive energy antiparticle, okay? So far, this kind of picture allows you, in more glorified models, to really have emergent relativity, even with interactions. You can do it. Now, the idea of emergent relativity, or Lorentz violation, is tightly constrained. We heard some of that this morning. Experimentally, and you know, the idea that maybe Lorentz invariance is an emergent property is an ancient idea. Here is a review of many of these ideas and the tests that one can put them through. And again, we heard this morning how different species of particles, even if you have got this brilliant way of getting emergent relativity in the far infrared, since we don't live in the asymptotic far infrared, we live somewhere, indeed, you might have different species having different speeds of light. And this is, there are a host of tests that allow us to constrain this. And so as far as nothing to do with gravity type matter is concerned, this is certainly a very, very tightly constrained game. Yeah.
That happens even in the far infrared. If you have more than
So that kind of depends on the whether you have a.
If you have multiple species which aren't related by a symmetry, then it happens.
That's true. It generically happens. Now you can imagine tuning it. You can imagine working hard by or that there's a principle that you're missing, or a symmetry that you're missing that does it. And but yeah, I agree with you.
In Euclidean space, you have such a symmetry.
So in a theory where probability is conserved, then, like, not Euclidean space, this is generically a worry. Okay. But still, one wonders whether there could be some principle, some symmetry connecting different species that ultimately, and there are some ideas too, which I won't go into, not mine, that might relate different species of particles. Okay. But it's certainly a tough problem. Nevertheless, I proceed because of. I claim the strong motivations for going down this path that I want to explain.
This is kind of state of the art, though, for the previous slide. There does not exist a Renton Signature Lattice Construction, which gives you an Ostergaard elevated emergence theory?
Yes, there is. So the one that you'd be most familiar with, there are even simpler ones, but the one that's most familiar is if you just do lattice gauge theory, not in Euclidean space, the way it's done for computational purposes, but in continuous time spatial lattice. That is a truly unitary theory. It can be quantized as a Hamiltonian formulation. It's quantum mechanical. There are no divergence or anything like that. It's, of course, not relativistic because it's a lattice theory of tops on links. Okay. And in the infrared, the residual gauge invariance provides enough symmetry that the thing that survives in the infrared is a single speed of light for all gluons. So that's an example. And there are many, many others, I should say.
Right, the pure blue theory, but not the theory with quarks.
I'm not fighting you on this. I'm not claiming more than that this is an idea, and it has a long way to go. Yeah.
Sorry. Yes. But, the fact that there is a maximum speed, of course, is not enough to say it's Lorentz invariant.
No.
I guess what you would usually do was build a clock with the excitation of the very lattice and see if this clock measures the relativistic effects when moving, for instance.
I agree. There's a question of how. Sorry, there's a question of what the most sensitive way. Suppose somebody hands you a box and says, this is not fundamentally relativistic, but it walks and talks relativistically. You can ask, what are the quickest tests you can do on it? Put that aside. Certainly, at a theoretical level, your job would not just to be to arrange some dispersion relations which are linear, or where they're linear and all the slopes look the same. There's the entire matter of the interactions also obeying the dictates of Lorentz invariance. And that's no small feat. I'm claiming the example I gave Flip is an honest example. It had both interactions and dispersion relations which flow in the infrared to the relativistic limit. And I'm not showing you that because I don't have time. But I'm happy, as I say, I was kind of maybe giving a talk to the wrong audience or something. So let's say this is a list of ads. They're not ads for me. I'm just quickly reviewing what the status is, and you'll see where it comes in. But after the talk, I'd be happy to go through one of these examples. They're really, to me, they're very beautiful, very inspiring, and they don't convince me for the reasons you say. There's lots of, to get a realistic world, there's no mean feat if you want emergent relativity. And not the least of that is to do with gravity, which I haven't even touched on. Okay? I keep pressing this. Okay. So, yes, it's tightly constrained, and it's even hard to do theoretically. But what about when you invoke gravity just to make life even harder? Okay. So, in the spirit of many of the questions of the morning, let's consider this precedent that we all know for local Lorentz violation. Okay, local now because Lorentz invariance is something you see in inertial reference frames, and the inertial reference frames tilt as you move around. Okay. There you see, I got into something tricky and it came back. Okay, so in some sense, here's the cosmic microwave background sitting in some frame, typically where it's on average at rest. And if you take off your glasses, then it looks like it's some sort of coordinate system. And that's the rest. That's an obvious preferred coordinate system, which trivially, therefore, breaks general coordinate invariance. And hence, you know, this is the thing you get into when you have Lorentz invariance with gravity. Is here's a way of doing it. Of course, what you've really done is you've just put in a state called the cosmic microwave background. If you removed all that background radiation, you would get back to pristine general coordinate invariance. Okay. So that's one way of doing it, that there's an ether, and the ether gives rise to Lorentz invariance, and we call that boring. But let's try and go in the other direction. You say, suppose there is a preferred frame because of some fundamental breaking of Lorentz invariance. Then, precisely because gravity is the dynamics of space-time, this preferred reference frame starts jiggling around and becomes a dynamical reference frame, which you might as well call a dynamical ether. Okay? And So it seems like you go both, you know, you go in both directions, okay? Ether implies Lorentz invariance and vice versa. But what's so revolutionary about an ether worth talking about is that if it's a sort of intrinsic part of the space-time fabric, then it can be a very unusual ether, okay? So let me just quickly run through what could be unusual about it. Nobody claims that because of the CMBR that you can propagate faster than the speed of light. Okay. On the other hand, we know on a lattice, in a theory with a lattice, yeah, there may be some interactions which in the infrared fake some relativistic theory, but nothing stops you adding a few instantaneous long-range interactions just for fun with a very small coupling so that every now and then you travel instantaneously faster than the speed of light. And of course, there'd be no problem of acausality just because you have superluminality, because it really fundamentally is a rest frame. Okay? Now, it turns out that this property that you could have, just because you have an ether, don't take your intuition about the CMBR or something as defining all of its properties. That's, again, part of the answer to some of the questions that came up this morning. You can have a certain amount of non-locality in space, and the interactions are superluminality. And while the structure of your theory will still look like some ether, it'll look like a rather bizarre kind of ether with very special properties. Another thing, if you have the CMBR, if you go to distances and look at gravitational interactions on very short distances compared to the typical spacing between photons, well, in this little region, general relativity will look pretty similar to the vacuum general relativity, okay? No big deal. However, an ether doesn't have to play by these rules. It can be one where if you go to short distances, there's a gravity sees the ether in a big way. Okay? So yes, there's no way to talk about Lorentz invariance and gravity without secretly having some ether-like substance to have to talk about. But it can do rather drastic things that a standard ether like CMBR cannot. It's less tightly constrained in the sense that we are not as good at, for example, restraining the speed of gravitational waves as we are, say, with the speed of light. And there is a host of papers in recent times that have been studying this idea of gravitational Lorentz violation. Okay, and I'm going in this direction because maybe it is related to dark energy in a direction that I will point. Okay, so one of the weird things about a Lorentz violation in gravity, I think, okay, I'm just going to speculate, is I think that it always, I think it's a theorem, and maybe we see it in the examples, I think it always implies something really drastic about the ether, okay, which smacks of negative energies, of instabilities. And here's, again, the dumb analog. I don't want you to take this too seriously, but here's the CMBR, and in this little hole here, I've just sort of cleared the photons away. And of course, relative to the energy of the uniform CMB background, cosmic microwave background, this hole is an absence of energy, of absence of positive energy. So you might say this is an excitation of the CMB, which actually has negative energy relative to the CMB ground state. Okay. So again, as in the discussions of this morning, the kind of ether we're talking about may actually not have the CMB-like energy, which causes it to redshift and causes it to curve space-time. But nevertheless, we should even worry. We should ask ourselves, in what sense might the ether have sort of negative energy or instabilities in it, intrinsic to it? I think we see this by example. One idea which might be more general, an attempt at a theorem, and I think it's going in that direction, and I'll just tell you what it is so far, what we see, but I don't know, maybe more can be done, is to try and force the issue. You see, you can try and hide from negative energies by, if there are negative energy fluctuations, don't talk to them. You make yourself out of the other stuff that's behaving well. And if you don't talk to it, then it's hard to excite negative energies and the instabilities that they imply. But black holes are a kind of way of sort of forcing everybody into the mix, sort of some thermalization of all the degrees of freedom. And so you can try and force the issue of negative energies or some of the pathologies that sort of smell like that to come out, to reveal themselves on sort of broad model-independent grounds. And a very interesting attempt was made in this direction by these guys and then followed up by these guys. And I just want to give a hint of why there might be these model-independent ways of trying to get at what kind of dangers you're playing with when you talk about Lorentz violation and gravity. So here's a black hole, but there are two species of particles with different speeds of light. And in some sense, the particle species B goes out of causal contact with the interior before species A, precisely because of the different speeds of light. Okay. And what these guys argued, and in fact they argued more, but this is all that I managed to understand in a brief period of time, was that when you look at the Hawking radiation at this horizon and this horizon in the two different species, you would find, again, they argued within the ghost condensate model, but argued that this was more general, that the two temperatures you would have here would in fact be different. And this was already violating a kind of a sacred rule, which is that in equilibrium, the two species should be at the same temperature. And in fact, they tried to use this to hook up a mechanism for transferring energy from cold to hot. Okay. Now, these are exactly the kind of weird and wacko things, I think, that might smell of negative energies underlying these things, even when you've tried very hard to work on effective field theories of Lorentz violating gravity, where the negative energies have been hidden as much as possible or don't show up in perturbative processes. They may show up in this kind of thing. So actually, once you think that there may be a connection between Lorentz invariance and negative energies or instabilities, which is part of the answer to some of the questions I think that came up in the morning, you say, well, why don't we just face the nightmare head on? Okay, so let's just look, how bad can negative energy be? And so I want to go the other way and argue that actually these, I want to argue that Lorentz violation and negative energies in the presence of gravity, they go together, take them together. They're not two perverse ingredients, they're the same. So let's try to go the other way. So let's consider negative energy. So here's the most in-your-face, I'm not trying to hide form of negative energies. Here is the relativistic dispersion relation of some field where I've pretended it's fermions and filled up the Dirac C. And so this is the vacuum of Minkowski space. And here is this other purple species of particle, which I filled up the Dirac atmosphere and left the C open. Okay. Now, there are lots of negative energy states here. So here is a particle excitation with positive energy. Just to be clear, here is an antiparticle, the removal of a negative energy state, also with positive energy. Okay, but this is what I mean by ghosts. Here is the removal of a positive energy state, which therefore has negative energy. And here is the addition of a negative energy state, which therefore also has negative energy. Okay, so just that's the distinction between everything. And yikes. Yeah, I am that clueless. Okay. So now, if these two species didn't talk, fine, no problem. But if they talk, we want to compute what is the lifetime of the vacuum state. This is what I've defined to be is the vacuum state, the thing that looks like the excitations on top of it are relativistic. And you can estimate that no matter what the nature of the interaction, and no matter how small the coupling between the blue particles and the purple particles, if there, that you can have processes where suddenly out of this point, this is not a Feynman diagram, out of this point, a pair of blue particles and a pair of antiparticle pair of these ghost particles emerges. It costs no energy, so there was nothing, zero energy, and then this emerged, but the energy cancels between positive and negative energies. And what you can show is that if you try and calculate the lifetime or the width of the, you know, of the Minkowski vacuum, one of the phase space integrals you always have to do is the interval over the boost over the reference frame in which the picture looks like this. You always have to do that in a Lorentz invariant theory. And if you integrate over the boost, precisely because it's non-compact, you get infinity. No matter how small the coupling between the two species, you cannot stop but get infinity, okay? Which is to say that the lifetime of Minkowski space is zero, instantaneously boom, okay? Again, this came up earlier today, and this was certainly discussed by these guys in studying one of, you know, phantom dark energy earlier. So this is something we have to worry about. Of course, the key thing is we assumed Lorentz invariance. That's where we got into trouble. You don't need to, and that's what I'm pointing to. Of course, the word ghost is a relative word because you can turn these pictures upside down. What you call energy or minus energy is up to you. And so really, it's only when they couple to each other that they know that somebody's the ghost. They don't necessarily agree on who that is. Okay. Okay, so how does this go proceed into field theory, if we're going to try and build realistic models of anything? Classically, it's quite easy. And the picture is really this, that you need somebody to be gravity, okay? You've got to have graviton somewhere. And actually, I'm not sure if I wanted to do this one first. Let me see. Oh, sorry. Yeah, maybe I'll do this first. How does Lorentz violation help? Okay, well, so here is a picture which, again, can be realized in this quantum spin chain way of doing things or in any of the more elaborate ways of getting emergent relativity. Is instead of the exactly straight dispersion relations, we can on the lattice, we get this kind of dispersion relation. And we can fill the Dirac C for one species of particle, and we can fill the Dirac atmosphere for the other species of particle. And this is just some state. It's an excited state of the spin chain, okay? But you can certainly do it. You can write down the state, and then you can talk about little excitations on top of those. Okay. You see, this is the true vacuum, at least with fixed particle number. This is the true vacuum of the spin chain. And so the Minkowski vacuum with ghosts is just some state. There was no ghost fundamentally. The quantum mechanical spin chain doesn't know beans about ghosts. Okay, it just has some ground state. So the existence of ghosts just says you're operating around some, in the vicinity of an excited state, but an excited state which, when you don't have couplings between these two sectors, looks like Lorentz invariant physics. So the whole catch is Lorentz invariance is a property of an excited state, then automatically you're in the realm of ghosts. Okay. So I'd like to shift to this. Why is this of any use? I mean, why are we going down this doubly loaded path of Lorentz invariance and ghosts or negative energies? And the reason is because what you'd like to understand the quantum stability of dark energy, why is dark energy so small, is ideally small means close to zero, and so ideally you're looking for some sort of a symmetry for vacuum energy, okay? Vacuum. Because that certainly vacuum energy in quantum field theory certainly is a contributor to dark energy. So this is, again, I apologize that I dumbed down quantum field theory, but maybe that's the easiest way to keep track of things anyway. So for some particular mode of momentum, we can have zero particle, one particle, two particle, three particles, and so on. And we can house that to be quantum field theorists, we house that in harmonic oscillators, okay, one for each momentum mode. And of course, it's this zero-point energy here that would contribute to the vacuum energy when we couple it to gravity. Okay, so this is some matter field. And of course, there are interactions. So the different momenta P modes can interact with each other, and of course, they can interact with themselves. And roughly, I'm just going to draw interactions, the fact that they're interactions as some sort of anharmonic oscillator. Of course, there's really a harmonic oscillator for every mode of momentum. But here is the cartoon. There's an anharmonic oscillator. This zero-point energy is now some complicated function of every detail of this picture. And our problem is that for particle physics scales, okay, with masses that are this size, of order 100 GeV or so, that the typical zero-point energies are enormous compared to the observed dark energy scales. Okay. So really, we'd like a symmetry to deal with that, to just somehow cancel this complicated function of masses and interactions out. And here is a seemingly boneheaded symmetry, which is, you say, look, somewhere I'll draw this, you know, a zero line of energy, and I'll say that there's symmetry between energy and minus energy. That's the symmetry, okay? And we call that energy parity. And you can dignify it with a commutation. Normally, a symmetry is some charge that commutes with the Hamiltonian. But in order to really say this precisely, that really there's a symmetry where energy goes to minus energy, it's an anti-commutator, which is why I put that anti there. Okay, so this is HP plus PH is equal to zero, where P is the thing that exchanges the blue and the purple, okay, these two sectors. And clearly, okay, so here's the cancellation. There's the vacuum energy of the matter sector of non-ghosts. Here is the vacuum energy of the matter sector of ghosts. This is classical contribution. This is some quantum contribution. And of course, it all cancels out. The sum of this plus this is zero. And boom, you've solved it, okay? You get zero matter contribution to the energy density that is seen by gravity. As long as gravity is the kind of thing that couples to all of these degrees of freedom, then we're in business, okay? Of course, necessarily, you're stuck with ghosts. There they are, and we have to ask, how bad is it in the real world? Okay. So gravity is at least one interaction that connects these two sectors. Remember, if there's no interactions between these two sectors, then you have no problems. Each thinks it is a physical degree, you know, the standard degree of freedom. But gravity certainly connects, and so gravity will mediate vacuum decay, I mean, the decay of Minkowski space. So it's bad, okay? But the second thing to keep in mind is gravity will necessarily break the symmetry energy parity because it has to sort of pick a side. The graviton oscillators themselves have to be positive energy or negative energy. By convention, we'll say the graviton oscillators are all of positive energy type. And so gravitons break the symmetry. We hope it's only a small breaking. Let's come to that in a second. And two, it will mediate vacuum decay, and that looks off the top catastrophic for what otherwise is the simplest possible idea you could conceive of, right? So we're just going to go with the simple idea and see how bad things get.
Rana?
Yeah?
So in principle, there are cross terms that you could have written, right?
In principle, you could have. So we're trying for just a technically natural solution. You could have written terms that connect this and this in the absence of gravity.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is we're taking the minimal coupling we could between the two sectors, which is gravity, because gravity you need to couple to both sectors so that it sees both of these energies. We could have done worse, but we're going to do it this way and ask whether the result is radiatively stable. But that leaves a lot of questions unanswered, but radiative stability is my minimal standard.
Yeah. Take your screen.
Oh. When that happens, Minkowski space decays. Okay. Sorry, down here. Okay. So, what are the constraints on vacuum decay? Well, here are the fine. Now, these are Feynman diagrams. These are not diagrams of space. Here are the Feynman diagrams for nothing goes to something, and so here it is: photon, two photons gravitationally coupling to the ghost sector and two ghost photons coming out. Remember, this ghost sector is literally a mirror image. It's not a random ghost sector. It's a mirror image of the standard model. Okay, it has photons in it. So this is it. And there are other processes like this, although this will be as deadly as we need to consider. And you want to ask, the question you want to ask here, what's the right question, normalized question, it's what's the probability for one of these events of nothing going to something happening per unit volume, per unit time, okay? And the answer is, say up to some pi's, which who cares about, is given by 2 powers of Newton's constant, that's in Planck to the fourth, and whatever is, remember, this answer would just be infinity if we didn't have Lorentz violation. So somewhere there must be some Lorentz violating cutoff, maybe a lattice, maybe something else. Something has to come in. So we'll just call that something lambda, this cutoff, and imagine that it cuts off energy and momentum, and there's no connection between the two. So this is the going rate cutoff for energy and momentum separately. And this would be an estimate of the result. Of course, the exact number would depend on the exact details of the cutoff, but this is the going rate. So this is very similar to the constraints that apply, again, to this idea of phantom dark energy that was studied by these guys, and consistency with what they quote, what I think we get, is that consistency with the cosmic gamma ray background would require this cutoff to be smaller than an MeV.
But when you think that there should be necessarily cutoff, you put imagine a situation when gravitation constant, for instance, is decreasing when you go to a very high moment, and then this coupling disappears.
Yeah, so that would turn out, in this calculation, that would turn out to be a kind of, I didn't say where this cutoff came from.
Yeah.
It could be a shutting off of the gravitational strength.
It affects gravity or when it goes to large momentum? Because even if you put a cutoff on some virtuality,
exactly,
you still have an integral over the Lorentz group, which is in.
But coupling constant
goes to zero.
This is not from Lorentz group, this is from
cutoff. No, it has to be a Lorentz violating cutoff.
This is Lorentz violating.
Otherwise, even if your process is a very small virtuality and slips under your cutoff, it still can be at a large boost.
So you mean that this lambda 4 comes from boosts also or not?
I mean that it's, if you like, cutting off both energy and momentum. So it's cutting off boost. There is always in these diagrams, one part of the phase space integral is an integral over the boost of the frame of, say, the photon.
Right? But if you imagine, for instance, that there is cutting constant, gravitational cutting constant goes to zero.
The only difference that makes to this calculation is, in some sense, it implements a kind of a smooth cutting off of the diagram.
Yeah.
In exactly, however, with this estimate, where lambda is the scale at which your gravitational constant suddenly stops being constant.
So, but cutting gravitational direction from scale is enough to make
No. This cutoff has to be very, you see, far sub-Planckian. So this is noteworthy. You know, we would have been happy if it was Planckian. This is the answer. Just.
I take this seriously as a model of the universe, then you need.
You don't take it serious.
Well, I don't know. You need a huge asymmetry in the early universe, right? Between you and Berkeley.
I'm coming to the early universe. Hold that thought. Okay.
Sure,
yes.
So before going to the early universe. I'm already confused in this one.
Are you saying this is a causal?
No. I'm saying that. So this is my question.
Yeah.
So I can imagine loops with virtual gravitons in which the momenta flowing in the graviton lines are below your cutoff.
Yeah.
Okay. So then these loops should generate like couplings between the two sectors just at first by 1 over a Planck operator.
Right.
And what do you do there? If we have that
with powers of lambda in the numerator, right?
May not necessarily be the power of oil.
Okay, you can have it in tree level.
Another way of saying it is the strength.
Why is tree level fine? Because you are getting, it's fine as long as what Grauman is telling us. Tree level, you can get rid of these processes by cutting them off with Lorentz invariant in the graviton line. But now I'm asking you about virtual graviton. I can integrate out, and now I'm left with the interaction between the two sectors, which doesn't involve the graviton itself. It's a loop diagram.
True, but what's the strength of that operator?
Right.
It is given by the strength of gravity below lambda. The dimensionless strength of gravity is lambda over M Planck. And so these things will be of order lambda squared over M Planck squared, which is of order, in other words, their contribution to this kind of process is like a loop, correct? You know, is like stringing one other graviton across here. It's just subdominant to this. But that exists. There's no question that those interactions exist.
Okay. Yeah, but
this is the dominant one.
But there the cutoff is much higher.
No. The cutoff would be lambda. In other words, if you do a graviton loop, the cutoff of the loop is lambda.
No,
you know
the
nothing.
Loop. Of course, the loop, yes, but I'm asking now about the process. Now, let me take the interactive operator and look at the process in which I produce two normal particles and two ghost particles.
Are you just talking about this, where I have an extra graviton?
I want to integrate it out then.
Sure, but that'll just be some, you can do that, but you agree, numerically, it'll be of order just putting an extra graviton here.
Of course, but here you're getting away because you can cut off this line by putting a very low cutoff, Lorentzian Lorentzian, on the graviton.
No, on the graviton coupling.
Exactly, but there...
There, too, there's a graviton coupling to matter, and that's
the concept. Now, it's a concept interaction between ghost and ghost. There's no difference with graviton.
Right.
So what are you cutting off there?
Right. Here. Are you saying that you could have phi squared, chi squared, and then there's some lambda squared over m Planck squared?
Right.
No, but there will be a form factor in that because you integrated out something that wasn't Lorentzian.
So what? Now it's a loop. It's a local counter term which I have to include in there. Now
but it'll be a Lorentz violating counter term.
So what?
When you go to large formula,
wait. The trouble is. I think I agree with Doc, which is this term is something when you integrate out. You only get a local term if you're going below the scale at which this cutoff is acting. So this is certainly true. Let me draw the diagram. Phi, chi. As long as if the momentum transfer in this direction, in this channel, the momentum transfer here is much bigger than lambda. Then you agree you're not going to get a constant.
Sure, but the point is that I can now have an arbitrarily large momentum flowing in the.
You can have an arbitrarily large momentum going this way.
Right. Okay.
But you see, you can't. That cuts off your phase space because you see, the process you want is where this nothing goes to. So you see, you actually need a huge momentum transfer because you have to take. This has to be positive energy, and this has to be positive energy.
And the other ones are negative.
And these have to be negative energy. So the excess, the fact that you have positive energy coming out like this means you have to have positive energy flowing this way. Right? And you have to have large, if you want to have a huge phase space for these photons, you must allow a large amount of energy to flow this way. But large energy flows this way is being cut off.
If you put in a form factor, the Hertz says you're going to violate the equivalence principle.
This is definitely the price of Lorentz violation is you do violate the equivalence principle. It's in the bones of Lorentz violation that you will, because there's a preferred frame. And of course, this form factor, we'll talk about it a little later, this form factor has to be such that for long wavelength processes, such as the ones where we actually have data on the equivalence principle, it shouldn't be seen.
No, but there is a...
It should only act at high energies or a short wavelength.
There is a constraint on the vacuum polarization graphs. From atomic physics, where you bring in the equivalence principle, which is quite constraining.
Sorry, which experiment are you talking about?
QED.
Yeah. For example, the binding energy of hydrogen should gravitate.
The binding energy.
Yes. See, your question must be too hard.
Binding energy.
Yes. Good. In fact, this approach, compared to my older approaches, is a precisely response to this question. That is diagrammatically, the question being asked is this. Here is a picture of a hydrogen atom. As a beta-Saltpeter equation, okay, and the question is now gravitons. In an external gravitational field, the graviton can couple here, it can couple here, and it can couple to the binding energy in quotes, the binding energy. And you better have the sum of all of these three if you want the equivalence principle. And real light show. So, but in fact, I'm not throwing away any of these three. Why? Because when you do these tests, this is a long wavelength graviton. And the long wavelength graviton couplings, I'm not touching. It's only when it's a short wavelength or highly off-shell graviton that I'm modifying the coupling here. So even though this momentum transfer by the photons inside a hydrogen atom are highly virtual by the scale of dark energy, that can keep going on. I'm not touching that. I'm only touching the gravitational coupling there, and I'm only doing that when the gravitons are very hard or very virtual. But I'm not doing that here.
Just one more comment.
But I'm happy to talk about it. I mean, I've given that some thought, and I would be happy to talk about it after this. Lights, please. Okay. So then there's the... Well, here, sorry. So now I should just zip back to this. Which is just to say, okay, how do you formalize some of these things in field theory? Not very hard. In fact, this really is the classical version of this story was written down by Linde as basically an idea for dark energy back in 1984. And gravity chooses, again, a certain sign of kinetic term with some bare vacuum energy that you might want to throw in. Hopefully, we set this to be small. And then the vacuum energy you can't decide about comes from matter couplings. And the ghost is a copy, a carbon copy of the functional form of the Lagrangian applied to the ghost fields, but with a negative sign. Okay, so that's the classical version of this energy parity story. But this gravitational term breaks that symmetry. Of course, 1 over m Planck is the coupling, and you're hoping that in some sense that's small. We'll come to that. We'll calculate the leading correction to saying that gravity breaks this perfect symmetry. For quantization, it's rather straightforward to canonically quantize this, treating these as negative energy excitations. And basically, standard propagators look like this, and ghosts, everywhere you see an I, you have to put a minus I. Okay? This is how you would quantize it as if it was a relativistic theory. Then on top of that, you have to remember that some short enough wavelengths, Lorentz violation must come into the game. Okay, so it's from there, if you like, that you're even getting these Feynman rules. And you can also do loops. Okay, you can look at the loops. And really, since gravity breaks energy parity symmetry, there must be some residual dark energy left over, because you haven't got perfect cancellation of vacuum energy. Gravity will always asymmetrize it at some order in radiative corrections. In fact, you're just dominated by graviton loops themselves, which certainly break energy parity, and as seen by gravitons on the external lines. Okay. So if this diagram had been written in a relativistic theory, then all of these diagrams, the sum over all diagrams like this, would be the sum over some constant number with, you know, no external lines, one external line, two external lines, and so on, expanded in powers of the external graviton. And it would all assemble perfectly into the square root minus g times some constant vacuum energy. And we'd call that a cosmological constant. But this is not Lorentz preserving, and these loops are very sensitive to the highest momentum in the loop, which definitely sees Lorentz violation. And so instead, what you're going to get is some going rate cutoff of order, the cutoff that we have talked about, the Lorentz violating cutoff, and terms which have no legs, one leg, two legs, and so on. But the precise coefficients will not be known unless I know exactly which Lorentz violating theory I have. But it'll walk and talk like some form of dark energy, and that certainly means we want to bound it experimentally by a few times 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. Okay? But the interesting thing is, this would not, since it's not a cosmological constant, it would not have, if you like, the W equals minus 1 equation of state of a cosmological constant model of dark energy. It would have to be something different. And one interesting thing. Why does any of this matter? Partly because if that's something that's going on, this is a measurable quantity that's going to get better measured in the future. There's another thing, which is this scale is very interesting because of the historic times we live in terms of testing gravity at short distances. This turns into some order 100 micron scale for testing gravity, and this cutoff on gravitational momentum should show up in the Feynman diagram that corresponds to Newton's law. When you get to very short distances, the momentum through the graviton line gets large, and you should see a form factor in Newton's law. So here in blue is Newton's law, but you should see some turnover, some cutting off of the high momentum or small wavelengths that are present in the Fourier transform of Newton's law. That should get chopped off, and you should see that. And again, this is a sort of accessible scale. This is my best estimate of the sort of line in the sand. If you go below this, you should start picking up on this idea. And indeed, these best tests are being done now in the sort of ETWASH or ETWASH collaboration, pun intended. And this is where they're down to. Okay, this is what has been ruled out. They're ruling out deviations of Newton's law down to this, but I have some confidence they will explore this. And that's another reason why you want to care. These are some of the ideas that can be tested. It's a good thing to pursue them to the bitter end. OK, so I think this is Justin's question, which is the asymmetry. There's such a symmetry between ghosts and us. Why are ghosts so rare, apparently, given some of the bizarre properties that they have? And actually, there's a really beautiful story. It didn't have to be so. And being such a beautiful story, we didn't think of it. That again goes back to Linde, and it's got a purely classical form. So I'm just going to repeat it, okay? Which is, you have some modest phase of inflation where there is some modest asymmetry in the initial conditions of the inflaton in this side. And of course, there must be some ghost inflaton in this side. And both are falling down, but you can imagine, for some random reason, this guy is behind this guy. And of course, this one wants to fall up because it has negative kinetic energy. This is going down. This is down for him. This is down for us. So this is how things start in some very modestly asymmetric initial conditions. Now, a little later, this guy is still on the slope, on the gentle slope, whereas this fellow is reheating the ghost sector. Okay, that's what you'd think. He's reheating the ghost sector, but there's a problem. This fellow is now dominating the energy density seen by gravity, which means that you have inflation going on. And everybody sees that background inflating space-time. And so these oscillations are getting redshifted away. And the ghost inflaton ends up at the bottom of its hill, coal, stone coal, okay? It's being inflated away, all the fluctuations being inflated away. And yet inflation is still going on in this sector as this thing modest slowly makes its way down. So you have an empty ghost sector. And then later, the visible inflaton reheats, but that does not get inflated away, okay, in this story. Okay? So then you have something here and zero here. So there's a huge asymmetry in this picture. So this is, I don't know, was that actually the question that you were asking? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. So I just want to emphasize how weird this stuff is by talking about Newton's ghost. He's apparently turning in his grave right now. So basically, suppose this inflation doesn't have to be the inflation. This has to be just the last inflation, okay, where we got rid of the ghosts. But suppose some ghosts are still around, a few are around. One, again, set of interesting questions is, can they be detected? You see, they're a very, very exotic form of dark matter. For example, just look at sort of even in the Newtonian limit, they're interesting. If you take a ball of ordinary stuff and a planet of ordinary stuff and a chunk of ghost stuff and say they're the same mass, you have this very interesting effect. They both move in this direction, with the separation between them constant. Okay. The asymmetry of direction is point is from ghost to non-ghost, where gravity tells you who's ghost and who's non-ghost. The relative forces, well, ghosts repel, non-ghosts attract. Small ghosts are attracted to big non-ghosts, but small non-ghosts are repelled from big ghosts. So it's weird stuff. Okay, so really,
I don't see how the universe starts expanding in your previous story. Because naively, I would say energy almost cancels, so H is zero. And
almost. So that's why, just so I didn't have to think about it too much, I started the story here, where they're not perfectly canceling or anything. This thing
so
is
the universe still is expanding slowly.
Slow.
But you need a huge.
But this guy then comes to its hill. It's only slow expansion, and it falls down.
You need huge vacuum energy to get 60 electrons.
Now, I'm not in this problem. I'm not attempting. So I'm not trying to solve 10 problems at the same time. So I'm not attempting to even claim that this inflation is the one responsible. It may be. I don't see an argument. I'm not trying to say this inflation is the one that has to do the job of standard inflation. This is a ghost-busting inflation of that sort. Okay, so these are some of the things that you can say on general grounds, and I hope to have deduced why they were interesting. But of course, you'd like to say, what kind of theory can actually implement this Lorentz-violating cutoff lambda? You see, in effective field theory, we do know how to write down Lorentz-violating gravity theories and study them and debate their pluses and minuses and what worries us. But now we want to do something where we're making heavy use of Lorentz violation to somehow have a momentum cutoff. Not a cutoff on 4 momentum squared, p squared or something, but just on, say, momentum or energy separately. So I'm just concentrating on momentum. And this is what I've been trying to pursue with Matt Schwartz. Of course, the spirit of it is like the lattice. In fact, you could try and build a lattice theory of gravity. And people have tried, but I think we have a stronger checklist of what needs to be accomplished than is standard. So rather than pursuing the lattice, we were hoping to make life a little bit easier on ourselves by at least maintaining spatial rotational invariance. And roughly, you want to keep throwing in form factors which are like this. You see, if you didn't have Lorentz invariance, if you had Lorentz invariance, the spatial form factor would come with, would actually be a space-time form factor. And the space-time form factor would then, depending on exactly how you implement the form factor, would have ghosts or various other pathologies. Ghosts in not even this bad sense, the usual sense. So the idea is by sort of putting these things into the Lagrangian, you can maintain locality and time. You know how to quantize the theory. It's got a Hamiltonian form. All that good stuff. You just give up some sort of locality in space. That's the idea. Okay. And we have just, this is a technical statement, been working in the simplest coordinates, which is sort of the co-moving coordinates for the ether, where the ether doesn't continuously show itself in your face. And we are trying to make, what's the rule? The rule is to try and maintain perturbative unitarity in the Feynman diagrams. So let me just quickly say what just the issues are, and people who want to talk to me in detail about exactly what we're doing will have to talk to me afterwards. You're trying to sort of lambda deform some Feynman rules for gravity, okay? And in fact, you want to do it to a sort of gauge fixed general relativity. So you have to choose some gauge for fixing general relativity and then deform that in some Lorentz violating way. Okay? Because you are doing it in a Lorentz violating way, because there's an ether present, when you gauge fix, you're really changing the theory. At long wavelengths, when you don't see the ether, the gauge fixing is innocuous. Okay. So in Yang-Mills, an example of such a gauge fixing is Coulomb gauge, and that's all I'll talk about here. Roughly speaking, what we want to do is take, in Coulomb gauge, you take your gauge invariant relativistic Lagrangian, and if you like, split it into quadratic terms and interactions, and in the interactions, you plug in this form factor so that the interactions shut off at high momentum transfers, but not at low momentum transfers. Okay, this is the simple idea, and then there's a number of complications that you run into as you just go like a robot through trying to make sure the theory is weakly coupled and that you get the right long wavelength limit. I'll just point out what the central worry is that we worry about. You guys can tell me yours if you're experts. That a Coulomb gauge propagator looks like this. The nice thing about this propagator is that it only has the two propagating degrees of freedom have energy poles. So there's no sense that there's any wrong degrees of freedom that can propagate. There are no waves that can propagate with which are not the usual graviton, or in this case, gluon waves. The bad news about, so it's a sort of manifestly unitary propagator. The bad news about this kind of propagator and the gravitational equivalent is that it has poles which are not energy poles. They are sort of interaction at a distance, Coulomb interactions. And normally, these things, if you look at all the sum of all Feynman diagrams, all 1 over p spatial terms like this always rearrange with other propagators to look like the usual relativistic propagator. But that requires the Ward identities to be maintained. If you don't break gauge invariance, remember, Lorentz invariance is a gauge symmetry of gravity. So what's wrong with having these propagators? Fine, you have superluminality in your face because you don't have this E squared. It's just action at a distance, 1 over r. But what's the problem with that? Well, the problem is actually perhaps the only thing we can think of is a kind of strong coupling problem, which is if you have E much bigger than P, then this propagator falls off much slower. In fact, it does not fall off, whereas this propagator does fall off. So some of the Feynman diagram, the power counting, is this theory a weakly coupled set of Feynman amplitudes, is a delicate question where you have to keep track of this. And what we're doing right now is trying to make sure that these kind of bad behaviors cancel in the sum of all Feynman diagrams by keeping track of a kind of residual gauge symmetry which is not broken even with our form factor. Okay, so I better stop. That's where the technical action is, and I'd be happy to sort of give some more idea of what's going on there after the talk. But basically what we're trying to do is build perturbative and unitary graviton amplitudes with this lambda cut on momentum space as the prelude to implementing energy parity. Of course, there's things, just because you succeed at the level of graviton amplitudes doesn't mean you're out of the woods. There are non-perturbative instabilities that you can't see in the graviton S matrix. Large redshifts is an example of that. All of these ideas you would like to rethink in light of what I think is a successful idea, the holographic principle. I think all of this is worth thinking about, partly because I think there's a chance that with some framework with equations attached, not hand-waving, that you could identify some of the most promising experimental and observational tests. Okay? There's a host of wonderful experiments that people can do or have done in testing general relativity, and it's amazing in thinking through this stuff exactly the sort of little crevices of opportunity that you have for testing.